digging out my soul. When there's nothing more to gain.
Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this 31st day of March. The third month of the year is almost over. Can you imagine that? So,
first quarter.
We've made it through the first quarter. Well, by the end of the day, we'll hopefully have made it through the first quarter, and here we are. And we welcome you to the program today. We have a lot going on, and we're very excited by the group we have assembled. And we'll start talking about the news of the day, the news of the weekend, and what we can, quote unquote, look forward to over the coming days. We welcome your letters as always. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Emily Honan is here, a grants analyst based in Albany, and certainly someone who has seen firsthand the state and federal funding can have on businesses, municipalities, and nonprofits. We'll talk a bit about that coming up. Always good to have you here, Emily. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
We really appreciate your time and being on top of all this stuff. Jim Ketterer joins us, senior fellow at the Bard Center for Civic Engagement. Good morning, Jim. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well. Nice to be here.
Anything going on in your world?
Well, I'll give a shout out to something that's going on at the Linda tomorrow night. They're showing one of the great cinema classics, The Blues Brothers,
and I
will be there. That is a very formative movie in my life. Great band, and you have Ray Charles, Aretha Franklin, Cab Calloway, John Lee Hooker. It's just a great movie.
About 2 years ago, I was having, maybe it was right coming out of the pandemic, and I thought to myself, I feel really bad I have not seen this movie in my life. I have not seen this movie. And so I downloaded it, and I started to watch it on a plane. And then I decided, this is not the place to watch this movie. So I waited until I got home, and I loved it. I had a great time.
Stands the test of time.
It certainly does. It's very, very good. John Landis, director, fantastic stuff. Good morning, Libby Post. How are ye?
I'm okay. How are you?
Good.
I'm good.
Well, happens to the best of us. You busy in the Capitol? I mean, the budget's due tomorrow. They don't come back to
they come
session
back
tomorrow.
Yeah. Right. I don't think we'll have a budget tomorrow. I think we'll have a budget in a week or two. They changed because of where Easter and Passover falls, they changed the makeup of the calendar a little bit. So they're here for another 2 weeks before Passover and Easter. So
they'll get it done.
Yeah, they'll get it done. I have no doubt. I'm pushing for, I got my $5 million from the governor for the Companion Animal Capital Fund, and we're hopefully both houses have the same amount in their budgets so that we can bring it up to $10 million. But with what's going on the federal level, even though this is bonded money, it's capital, so our great-great-great-grandchildren will pay for it, everyone's just a little jittery and a little nervous about that. And then today starts the day when candidates file their petitions. So I'll be doing a lot of that stuff today, too.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a busy,
so busy time.
Yeah, and it's very busy. Petitions are due by Thursday, which is great. And then, then the campaigns really start.
Well, we appreciate you coming and being with us this morning and taking the time out of all of your schedules to be with us to try to make sense of what is happening in our world. And let's go. Let's talk about some competitive House races, some interesting stuff going on, especially in Florida. Mm-hmm. And the repercussions are really interesting. I've read more than a couple of articles about this of Republicans, especially in these two Florida seats, not doing as well in the polling as they were expected to do, which is one of the reasons that Elise Stefanik was denied her entry into the administration. And sent back to Congress. Andy Borowitz had a piece. Did you see the Andy Borowitz piece this morning? There's Andy Borowitz. And
where is his? Are his
Well, I saw it on Facebook. I don't know where he goes. It used to be. It used to be with the New Yorker, and then I think he went off free. You know, on his own.
He got fired or let go, I should say.
So he has the Capitol all with the flags all at half staff, and he said Washington prepares for Lee Stefanik to return home. So that's the or return to Congress. So anyway, there are these competitive races, and voters in the districts are really looking at whether their vote not that long ago for President Trump was still something that they would do. And it is interesting to see how quick all of this has turned around. And they're looking at very, very close races. So these are to fill the two seats from Matt Gaetz and Waltz.
Right.
Waltz is National Security Director.
Oh, and he had that little problem with his cell phone and texting. And
Libby, please, let's not do a witch hunt here.
Oh, okay, fine. Yeah. But he was the guy, right?
He's that guy. Although, as far as crimes and misdemeanors, Matt Gaetz is nothing, you know?
Right.
So there's a lot to look at here, and we'll see voters in the district, which includes the stretch of the coast between St. Augustine and Daytona Beach, overwhelmingly voted for President Trump. But on Tuesday, they will cast ballots in what seems to be an unusually competitive contest to replace former Representative Michael Waltz, who stepped down to become Mr. Trump's national security advisor. Mr. Fine, who is facing Josh Weil, a Democrat and public school employee, is still widely favored to win, but with Republicans clinging to their House majority by just a few seats. It was clear this week that voters in the district are thinking about what the outcome of the race and another race of former Representative Matt Gaetz's seat in the Florida Panhandle could mean for Trump's agenda. It's important that we keep the seats, said Doreen Colby, a registered Republican who lives in Daytona Beach. We want to make sure that Trump can keep doing what he's doing. After tapping Mr. Waltz and Mr. Gaetz for his cabinet, Mr. Trump quickly endorsed candidates to replace them. Mr. Gaetz later withdrew from consideration as Attorney General, but had already resigned from Congress. But while Jimmy Patronis, Florida's chief financial officer, is expected to coast to victory in Mr. Gaetz's former district, which is extremely conservative, some Republicans have expressed concern about the 6th district race. How much can we put into these races off year, so close to the presidential election? Do we read too much into them?
No, I don't think so. I think these races, everyone's going to be energized to vote. I think that the Democrats in those areas will be energized. The Republicans, the Trumpers, will be energized. People are starting to feel the impact of what Trump is doing on the federal level. Florida is home to many, many veterans. And so it'll be interesting to watch. I think the Fine race has got more of a chance of flipping that seat than Gay Valmont, although she's really doing a lot of work. And so you never know. But there's a razor thin margin now. And I think this will help energize the Democratic base, but also will get people engaged in a way that they haven't been before. And Trump is helping doing that. I mean, you know, on a local level, I've got people coming out of the woodwork who want to do work, who want to do stuff. So, you know, whether we get to flip the House tomorrow or in 2026, it's going to happen. I really do believe it's going to happen. I think what Trump is doing is hurting his base. He's hurting his own people. the red states are the ones with the largest groups of people who get federal aid, whether it be aid to children with dependent, you know, and aid to family with dependent children, or any Medicaid, all of that. And what they're doing to the vets, firing vets who, you know, work for the federal government. This is not going to go over well.
So my question is, before we go to the other panelists, is 70 days he's been in office, and we just heard in my setup from the New York Times of what one voter said of, mm-hmm. you know, we want Trump to be able to do what we sent him there to do. Is 70 days enough time? Will they give him more than that, or will they react very quickly to the changes they're seeing and the tumult that has come as a result?
It's all according how aware, awake, and angry people are. It's really going to come down to that, and whether they're tracking and whether they think that this will make a difference.
Your awakeness and anger may differ.
Right.
Jim Ketterer.
Yeah, I think Trump won that district by 40 points. So it would be just a monumental uphill climb for a Democrat to win. I guess anything is possible, but it does seem unlikely. But what I'm also interested in with both of these races, having worked on elections and been an election observer around the world and in touch with a lot of people who are very much focused on the administration of elections, is to see how these elections play out. What kinds of things, particularly if a Democrat wins in that Waltz seat, there will be all kinds of claims that it was rigged, that
right.
it was dirty, that this and that and the other thing. But even without that, this is a good test case in this new environment to see how the elections play out, how they're administered, what kinds of complaints there are about the conduct of the elections. I mean, you know, Donald Trump just issued a few days ago a new executive order. It's hard to keep track, but this one is specifically on voting. And it is specifically designed to, so it seems, to limit the number of people who can vote. And I don't think that's in play yet in Florida, but the whole atmosphere around elections is fraught, and I will be very interested to see, and we probably won't know right away, but you know, to see the analysis of these elections after the fact.
Emily.
Yeah, I mean, I really don't want to be too optimistic for the Florida race. I feel like that one is a long shot. I would love if it was flipped, but I don't think that it's. I'm really trying to temper my expectations. 2026, I am more hopeful for, but again, expectations are being tempered by that new executive order, which is chilling, considering that at this point, voting is one of the only tools that most people have left, and he's trying to take that away too. So that's haunting. Although I want to be kind of positive because I have seen some reports of, you know, veterans being like, well, this isn't what we wanted. You know, we knew he was going to cut jobs, but not ours. And I'm like, well, you never think the leopards are going to eat your face. So it
is this part of the positive approach?
Yeah, that's right.
Leopards are going to eat your face?
You know, woman who voted for the Leopards Who Eat People's Faces party said, oh, I never thought leopards would eat my face.
Oh, God.
You know,
right. Okay.
But yeah, it's very sad to see that, you know, because clearly these people have been lied to, have been misled. But at the same time, it's kind of like, well, I mean, you really thought that you were going to be safe. But I have seen, you know, even when people have been directly negatively affected by Trump, they will, you know, it's just a lost cause at this point. Nothing you can say will get them to give them up.
Well, and even if it is, the question is, will they do it with only 2 months or 2.5 months
exactly.
of seeing with an interest just to see where it goes, especially if they feel that it's somehow going in the right direction.
Yeah, that's why I feel more hopeful for 2026.
And then we only have about a minute, so I'll just bring it up. But then Elon Musk is working this Wisconsin Supreme Court seat like nobody's business, and basically saying that our Democratic Republic the whole world just falls apart if we don't vote in this race. And
well, it's certainly not true. But what I find interesting about Wisconsin judicial races is that, unlike New York, they can talk about issues. They can say, "I'm a pro-choice Supreme Court candidate," or you know that, and which you can't do here in New York. It's verboten with judicial ethics, campaign ethics. But he's trying to buy people's votes. I mean, it's reminiscent of
million
you know,
bucks,
right? Yeah. You know, back in the day, people would walk around with rolls of $5 bills here in Albany, and to make sure that people voted the right way. But that doesn't happen anymore, folks. Just to be clear. But he's trying to buy people's votes, and there's a judge who wouldn't stop it, which I just don't understand. When I was a kid and there was a bad president, I always thought, well, at least the Supreme Court's there. Well, not anymore.
I just can't believe also that Elon Musk would be an effective representative for anybody's campaign. I mean, the polling on him is very
it's
low.
Horrible.
Even among Trump supporters, his numbers are low. And he just doesn't seem like he could possibly be effective. And yet he has inserted himself into this important race.
He showed up with his Packers cheesehead hat on and was ready to go. So we'll see happens. 2,000 people at that rally on Sunday night in Wisconsin. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome your input, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll be back right after this.
Days go by and I'm still missing you. I know I'm supposed to be getting it together.
Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. So while Elon Musk was in Wisconsin and handing out million-dollar checks, he spoke last night and said what's happening on Tuesday is a vote for which party controls the U.S. House of Representatives. This is for a court seat.
Well, that just shows how much he knows.
But that is why it is so significant, he said, referring to the key role that the court could play in congressional redistricting. Quote, and whichever party controls the House to a significant degree controls the country, which then steers the course of Western civilization. I feel like this is one of those things that may not seem that it's going to affect the entire destiny of humanity, but I think it will. That's a lot.
An ingenue.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he was in Wisconsin for a Supreme Court race, not in Florida for the congressional races. So
I'm here. Michael Labarara, a 25-year-old who installs solar panels in a Doge hat he bought online, said, I'm here for Musk. Some of the crowd wore Musk paraphernalia and said they wanted an up-close look at someone they had followed for over a decade. John Rosner, a retiree, sported a different Musk hat bearing the boring company name and said he was there basically to meet Elon, calling this moment the close I'll ever get to him. Then there's Robert Cool, Bob Cool, an 81-year-old retiree who was seated in an empty row to the side of the auditorium as he nursed an injury from a fall, said he had decided to make Mr. Musk's event the first political rally he had attended in his life. A Trump rally, he said, wasn't as precise. What do you think he meant by that?
I think that they're just trying to feed this narrative of, you know, the more private investment, the more private businessmen you get in the government, like the faster it's going to move, because they just have this idea that privatization, I mean, this is another article that we read, but privatization is the fastest way to everything. And they seem to view Elon as the Jesus of this movement somehow. Well, not somehow, because he calls himself that, essentially.
And to Libby's point of the time being spent here as opposed to the time being spent in Florida is interesting, but there's other surrogates down there. So
yeah, but I know, but he's talking about
the control of the Congress.
Control of Congress when he's there for a Supreme Court race. That's what, you know, it's like, do you know where you are, Elon? Do you know what you're talking about?
No.
Right.
We've got to pull a rabbit out of a hat next level, he said. We actually have to have a steady stream of rabbits out of the hat, like it's an arc of rabbits flying through the air and then landing in a voting booth.
He's a child.
Let's pause and think about that. Okay, I'm done. You?
An arc of rabbits.
An arc of rabbits. That's right.
Okay.
An arc.
You know, I can't tell if it's like this, you know, deep-seated, you know, psychological ploy to get us to focus on that instead of, you know, the things that he's really saying. But I don't know if he's smart enough for that.
We go to John, who says, I'm not too sure that Trump's base is becoming disenchanted with what he's doing. As long as Fox News is around, Trump's base will be alive and well and supportive of his agenda. We have seen that, although polls have indicated that there is a softening. But to what extent, we don't know. And also, do we trust the polls? Steve says, in discussing Musk's involvement in the Wisconsin judicial race, it needs to be mentioned that he wants to change the law that bans auto manufacturers from selling directly to consumers. Oh, yeah, there's that. There is a personal interest.
Yes.
Ingrained in why he is there.
Who would have thunk it?
Not just that he thinks it's cool to be in Wisconsin in late March.
Well, it is probably weather-wise a little cool.
Yes, well, that's true. Yeah. So what do we think, how much are we going to know Wednesday morning, do you think, Libby?
I think... On one hand, it could be a rout on all levels, and we would know, but I think it's going to take a couple of days probably.
And if both Republicans win, nothing really changes as far as the numbers go.
No, nothing changes. There's still a razor-thin thing. That's why Elise is staying in Congress, was to guarantee. Because what the tariffs are making the people, it's me, the tariffs are making the people in the North Country really unhappy. Because Canadians aren't crossing over the St. Lawrence anymore, and tourism is going to tank this summer. Lots of things are going to be impacted by all of this. And so when you have the North Country not happy, you know, you never know what could happen. And the guy, I can't pronounce his last name, but the guy who's been running, who was going to run in the special, the farmer from...
Yes.
Yeah, you know who I'm talking about.
He's still running.
He's still running. He's already got a big war chest. He'll keep the pounding and pounding and pounding. She won't have any town hall meetings. He'll do them, which will be great, right? And no one will be arrested at a town hall meeting when a Democrat does it, just saying. And who knows? I mean, it's a very red district, but it's... But Bill Owens represented it for a long time. He was a blue dog Democrat. You never know. And also Kirsten Gillibrand, but the configuration was a little different back then.
Much different. Yeah.
Yeah, but you never know. You just, you know, what's going to happen up in that race. And we might take one of these two seats. I would love to say that Valmont will take Matt Gaetz's seat, but it's really it's the panhandle. And it's really very red. But the other seat, he's within, I mean, some polls have him ahead. So,
but I think the Wisconsin judicial seat, that's close.
Ahead. Yes.
But that's a tight race,
right,
though.
Right, right. But they had a similar race a few years ago between a woman and another kind of MAGA judiciary candidate. And she won.
Right.
And I think the Wisconsinites are starting to wake up a little bit and realize this is not good for them either.
You mentioned the 21st. The dairy farmer who's running on the Democratic side is Blake Gendebein.
Yeah, right.
And he is running And as you say, now he has more time, but can you imagine the money that's going to be poured into that race?
Oh, I know. It's going to come from all over. It's going to be probably one of the most expensive house races in the country when all is said and done.
And imagine how much money is also being spent in these two Florida races, too,
yeah.
for that matter.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Gendebean is how it is actually pronounced. Gendebean. For those keeping track. And we will, too, now. There has never been such a blatant and egregious buying of an election, and for a judicial race at that. Come on, cheeseheads, reject the oligarchical activity. That from Casey. And then we go to this from Jane. Can anyone in any belief system point to where cult of personality worked out meaningfully well and safely for anyone but the personality? The degree to which people venerate people with ultimate power is astonishing to me. Veneration should be earned, and even then should be inversely proportional to power, because that's when whoever might have earned deep respect and reverence is most likely to break being human and all.
Well said.
That from Jane. Then we go to, I thought we had another letter, but maybe I don't have it in front of me. One moment, please. It's an interesting point about that cult of personality, because at one point it was just Trump. And now you have Trump and you have Musk, and it's interesting to see that dynamic. And I think many saw a collision course being set up and kind of surprised that it hasn't happened yet, but we'll see.
I'm still holding out hope.
Yeah, well, and then there's J.D. Vance in Greenland. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
those pictures are worth 1,000 words. They just are. Let's see. We go to Roger writes, Trump has already done enough illegal and unconstitutional acts to be impeached. We do not have until the midterms to creatively fight the various terrible actions already done. And perhaps impeachment is the only answer. For him to be serious about a third term, currently unconstitutional, is just about another example of dangerous his nonsense is. Do we really want to so rapidly destroy over 50 years of EU friendship and NATO, have a war with Greenland, Panama, or Canada, all 19th century imperialism at its worst? Somehow we have to stop this madness.
Can I just say that the writer mentions one thing in there that I've heard Senator Chris Murphy saying over and over again for the past few weeks, and that is that we don't have until the 2026 midterm elections. And, you know, that is, you know, that would be the kind of thing we would be shooting for mm-hmm. in normal politics. Yeah. This, Murphy is saying, and I think he's really compelling on this point, we are in the midst of an emergency. We are in the midst of an authoritarian takeover of the government of the United States. And all the kinds of things we've seen play out in just, what is it you said, Joe, 70 days of this administration so far. Imagine just the rest of this calendar year, much less getting to 2026. And so I have to agree with Murphy that and with this letter writer, I don't have any idea what the way out of it is. But I do agree with the idea that we're in the midst of this emergency. And as I've said on the air here before, I've encountered many people who just have this, I would say, failure of imagination about where we are, what we're in the midst of, and are reverting to just kind of the normal routine of politics. That's just not going to cut it. It's not going to work to address the situation that we find ourselves in.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll probably talk about this third term balloon that's being sent around and talk about that as well. We welcome your input, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this.
Chanting words of tolerance.
I will never truly be ready for the things we discuss about during the break. I'm just
thank God
after all these years, I still will not be ready. But anyway, good morning. Welcome back to the panel and to our discussion. We thank you. A couple of letters. Mary says, if a crisis, what can regular people do, especially those in red states?
Take to the streets.
Well, that's the big question, right? That's everyone. There was an article this morning that was, I thought, weirdly in answer to something that James Carville said months ago or weeks and weeks ago, which is, you know, the Democrats need to play dead.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a picture of Akeem Jeffries saying, you know, we're not going to do that. So I don't know to what degree this letter writer is looking at in the sense of what can be done. I don't know that anyone has the answer to that right now.
Yeah, I mean, I do find what Carville said to be very insightful. I know he's quite a character and mm-hmm. not everybody's cup of tea, but I think he really has a lot of credibility in terms of him being able to get people elected over the years. He really seems to understand the electorate in general. And, you know, he's basically saying, you know, this is really an incompetent group. Give them enough rope to hang themselves, and they will.
And it's true. It really is true. And it will blow up eventually. It's just the pain
right.
that's going to be, you know, everyone's going to feel and between now and then. I can't imagine that Trump's going to allow Musk to have bigger headlines than him, right? Or be sitting in the Oval Office in the chair or any of the kind of stuff that's been happening. And, you know, I think that'll blow up. This notion of what happened on Signal, right, with the Houthi plans. Oh, well, that was the reporter. It's fake news. I mean, people aren't that stupid. Right. They're just not that stupid. And what is it? You know, I mean, even the most rabid among us, while they'll believe Trump, must in the back of their minds go, well, you know what? I've included people on a text that I didn't mean to, you know, and so it does happen. So maybe he should be more careful because I need to be more careful. It's just. Weird.
Yeah, I mean, I think that. Yeah. Grossly understates what happened there.
Yes, but
I mean, I'm
it.
Not saying to yeah. you, I'm just saying that yeah. narrative, which is continuing, obviously.
Right, right. Yeah. But there, now he's calling it fake news and trying to undermine or make the reporter look like it was his fault. Well, no. It was your national security advisor's fault. Why doesn't someone take some responsibility? And that's the problem. No one there wants to take responsibility for their actions, other than when they cut
right.
everything.
And I think this is what kind of undermines Carville's argument, is that in normal times, if you give them enough rope, they'll hang themselves, mm-hmm. they'll do so many stupid things that, you know, something will happen from it. There seems to be no accountability,
right.
no consequences. Nothing is happening or is likely to happen from this Signal event. There's also no scrutiny of the actual military action that took place. Did it solve the problem? Short answer, no.
Right.
And so it just goes on and on. So, you know, I Carville makes a compelling point, but when you think it through, how will it really work? How will so many mistakes, one after another, lead to consequences? I don't see the consequences.
There was an article in the New York Times yesterday, front page, about President Trump asking his cabinet and staff and friends of if he should fire Michael Waltz. And that apparently has been the consumption over the last mm-hmm. couple of days of should I fire him, should I fire him, should I fire him. The line that got me in the article was that Trump made it clear that he had no problem with the using of Signal. He was mad at Waltz because he had Jeffrey Goldberg's number in his phone.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. But that
how bizarre wow. is that? Right. How bizarre is that?
I mean, and so that was and then in the NBC followed up with the NBC interview, which we'll talk a little bit about. The NBC interview where he said no one will lose their job as a result of this. I think that's probably true. I don't see why it would have happened by now, and why would it if your thing that you're maddest about is that
not really a fireable offense.
Right. He had somebody's phone number in his phone that he didn't like. So, well,
but this is... I think these are just not serious people also. Mm-hmm. I mean, think about – so the Signal thing is egregious. I mean, I held an above-top secret security clearance. If I had done something like that, I would have been marched out of the building and goodness knows what would have happened to me, something very serious. But aside from that, and aside from Trump being worried that that Waltz has Goldberg's number, he's probably worried that he was leaking things to Goldberg. But in addition to that – as I said before, we engaged in military action against the Houthis. And there's no talk at all about from the White House saying, well, we better assess how did that go, what's going to work, were the military plans that were put together insufficient to address the problem, et cetera. That would be the work of serious people mm-hmm. in the national security sphere. I'm sure some professionals at other levels are dealing with it, but you have the leaders worried about the optics and the Signal and Jeffrey Goldberg. It's such a distraction from the actual reality of, you know, we're in a shooting conflict. That should be the priority, and yet it's not.
Janet writes to us and says, yes, the incompetents may eventually sabotage themselves, but we still need to see our representatives fight for our democracy rather than playing dead, as Carville suggested. I agree with that in the sense that it's hard to just sit and watch, especially when people are being yeah. financially and even physically hurt in the process. Susan said, Libby.
Yes.
You da woman.
Oh, thanks so much. Like, you know, it's you da man came from what movie?
I don't know.
Oh, wait. It'll come to me, or someone will text me.
Okay.
Okay.
But there was a but after that.
Right. But.
Okay. But I disagree. There are that many stupid people.
Yep. Oh, no. I know. I'm just trying to be a little nicer every so often.
I'm just grateful none of them are my friends and family, Susan Aww. Writes. So that's good. Betsy writes to us and says, in all major U.S. cities and some international cities, huge rallies are set to happen on April 5th to protest against Trump's policies. That will be just after Trump's so-called Liberation Day, which I believe is on April 2nd. Linda writes and says, Libby, you're right. We have to take to the streets. We have to let our voices be heard. All over the USA this Saturday, April 5th, people will be marching.
I just say also, so I said before that, you know, I've observed elections and I'm interested in the conduct of elections. I'm also interested in the conduct of these protests. I'm interested to see what happens given the superheated atmospherics in the United States right now. I have lived in other countries where it's just illegal to have protests, but when they have happened, you also see that there are provocateurs in the crowd. Mm-hmm. There are ways in which a ruling regime wants to stir up violence and to use that as an excuse to crack down hard. I certainly hope that is not going to be happening here in the United States, but given what we're living through, I have to say I'm concerned.
JT is right there with you and says all it will take are acts of violence at resist protests, red flag or not, martial law will be declared, and perhaps no elections in 2026.
There are people who really, I mean, serious analysts who are saying this could be a long, hot, violent summer.
Oh, I think it's going to be a violent summer. I do think that.
Yes, the incumbents may eventually sabotage themselves, but we still... Okay, I read that one. I apologize. A repeat, but... Bernie says, as a Republican and somewhat reluctant Trump supporter, I can assure you that all my conservative friends want no part of a Trump third term. We also didn't vote for Musk. I see a flip coming soon in the midterms if this keeps up. We voted for Trump for border security and the economy as Biden was doing nothing. We didn't vote for war and limits on free speech either. I disagree with the panel 90% of the time, but love you all and love the show. Good faith conversations are always great. Bernie, we appreciate that, and we thank you for communicating with us.
And I do think we need to find ways to disagree in a civil manner, and so I really appreciate that letter.
Anne writes, voting is not our only option. Impeachment will be difficult or near impossible because of the midterms, but thousands of Americans are protesting. The town halls across the country illustrate this. In at least two states, voters organized absentee town halls for their senator or representative who refuses to hold a town hall. Protests are organized everywhere. Over 900 local protests will be held on Saturday. And I'm sure we'll be covering much more of that in the days to come. We'll take a break. We'll go over to news. And when we come back, we'll continue much more to discuss. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC. What does this age of man supposed to do? I could love for... Good morning. Welcome back to The Roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. So nice to have you with us. Emily Honan is here, a grants analyst based in Albany. Jim Ketterer, senior fellow, Bard Center for Civic Engagement and political consultant and lobbyist, Libby Post, all with us, and we thank you very much. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We do have a number of letters, and I will try to get back to those, but I'd like to get to some other topics first. And so we have some things other than just this to talk about, because there certainly is a lot out there. We mentioned this once, but I don't think we need to spend a whole lot of time on it. But President Trump said yesterday in an interview that he couldn't care less if auto prices rise because of his tariffs. I was thinking about this of, like, read my lips, no new taxes.
Right.
You know, like that one line that just completely obliterates your hopes of keeping office. And then saying something like that, which just is another day at the office for this administration and this news cycle. But he said on Saturday that he could not care less if car prices spike because of his 25% tariffs on auto imports, saying the levies will prompt more people to buy American cars. I couldn't care less. I hope foreign automakers raise their prices, because if they do, people are going to buy American-made cars. We have plenty, he said in an interview with NBC's Kristen Welker that aired Saturday. During the interview, he said he did not warn U.S. automakers against hiking prices on their cars, as reported by some news organizations. He said his message to industry leaders was, congratulations, if you make your car in the United States, you're going to make a lot of money. If you don't, you're going to have to probably come to the United States, because if you make your car in the U.S., there is no tariff. It was a remarkable, if politically perilous, statement from Trump amid ballooning costs on a wide range of goods. Voters' economic anxieties propelled Trump to the White House, as critics complained his predecessor wasn't sensitive enough to the impact of persistent inflation on everyday Americans. On the campaign trail, Trump vowed that prices would begin to come down on his first day, day one. But they remain stubbornly high, with potentially more economic pain in coming days as more tariffs take effect. That from the Washington Post.
You know, I just did a quick Google on where we get our cards from.
Quick Google.
And Mexico, Japan, South Korea, Canada, Germany, the UK, Slovakia, Italy, Sweden, China are the top 10. And that's all the major, our major companies like GM, and they are using foreign workers to build their cars because it's cheaper. So this is going to impact. It's not like it's the Japanese automaker, right, where they make it in Japan and ship it over. I'm sure there's some of that. But this is going to make the American auto manufacturers not happy.
He couldn't care less about that, though.
But the thing is that that's his base. Those are his people, you know, mega millionaires, you know, the oligarchy.
Not Elon.
Yeah, he's hurting him. I know. Elon does everything in America.
Yeah.
Which is all about, I mean, let's just connect those dots for a minute.
I'm surprised he isn't just coming right out and saying it and just saying, you should buy my buddy Elon's cars that are made in America. Mm-hmm. I mean, well, he can just say that at this point.
He did when he brought him up to the lawn of the White House, for God's sakes.
Yeah, right.
I mean,
he?
You know, yeah, I mean, that's when the South Lawn becomes a dealership, I think you look at those things. Jim?
Yeah, you know, I wondered for a long time when Trump was talking about tariffs and he'd be questioned about them. People would say, you know, this is going to have this is going to cause a rise in prices. And he would say, no, it's not. The tariff will be paid by the other government. And so that's just not how tariffs work fully. And so I have wondered, well, does he just not know or does he just not care? He's answered that question.
It's a little bit of
both. He couldn't care less.
I think it's a little bit of both.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think he's ignorant about how all this works, and he just shoots his mouth off, and he doesn't care.
Yeah. I mean, it would be hard for him to not know now, though, because he's got to be told from every corner, this is the result of this. In terms of the American cars, I mean, as I understand it, it's really hard to figure out what is an American car because so many of the parts, right, particularly with Canada and Mexico, can be partially done here in the U.S., partially in Mexico, partially in Canada. And, you know, the car is a product of our global trading system. And so to re-engineer that so everything is done here is going to take a long time and is probably going to result in much, much more expensive cars. And so is that what people voted for?
And I don't even know. I mentioned this on Friday. How do you keep track? If you have a car that is Ford and 22% of it is made elsewhere, well, then how is that charged with that tariff? And that would mean that a mid-size, I don't know this for sure, I'm just guessing, but that would mean that a mid-size four-door from Ford would be a different price than perhaps Chrysler, who has a different setup with different vendors, mm-hmm, that maybe 17% of the car is made or 33%. And it seems like it's going to be a mess.
Well, mm-hmm. I mean, presumably as those parts cross the border, they're hit with the tariff, and then the auto manufacturer here has to absorb that cost and will pass it along to the consumer.
Correct.
And so, and the car is more expensive. Well, cars were already expensive. And so now they'll be more expensive. And the president, who is levying these tariffs, says he couldn't care less.
But, you know, what's interesting, though, the next step of all this. So buy my buddy Elon's cars. Okay. They're all electric, but we're going to really start drill, baby, drill, because we want fossil fuels. So how does he feel about that? You know, how does Elon Musk feel about that? Because these, you know, they don't want electric cars.
And that's also, I mean, just another area of great ignorance, because the United States is already a fossil fuel driller and exporter. And so that's not something that hasn't been going on. It's already been going on. And I guess if you just say it enough times, right, drill, baby, drill, it sounds like, well, we have to do something that we weren't doing already. We've been doing it. We've been doing it very successfully. Now, the environmental concerns are something aside. Just the facts are we are a fossil fuel exporter.
I mean, it's the Nazi trope. If you say things often enough, long enough, people will come to believe it, even if it's a lie.
I'm just saying that's what they've been doing the entire time. They just say straight up lies. Sometimes they'll even, you know, contradict themselves, as we were saying about Trump and the tariffs. At first it was, oh, they'll absorb the cost. Now it's, I don't care. You know, if they're wrong, it doesn't matter. And earlier you said something about something being politically perilous for Trump. I have a feeling that, I don't know if it's now, but I feel like somewhere in the near future, there's not going to be anything that's politically perilous for him.
Well, I think, I mean, you know, this goes back to, could you shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and not, yeah, and nothing would happen. And I think that has remained the case.
He already said, long live the king.
Yeah,
I mean, right. What
more do you want with, how more can you, what more can you take from that, I should say. A couple of letters we'll go to, and let's see. We go to Charlie, who says, Trump is not worried about inflation. Historically, hyperinflation has strengthened the position of autocrats and ushered in authoritarians. He wants uncontrolled inflation. That from Charlie. Joel says, at an ICE detention facility in Florida that's meant to hold 500 people but currently holds 4,000, three people have already died. Not enough food, not enough water. Each prisoner gets one cup of water per day. I've been saying since Trump's first term that he and his fascist horde want their very own Holocaust, and it's here. How many have to die before the death camps are indeed reported? That from Joel. Then Carl says, Bernie Sanders and AOC are two of the few Democrats fighting Trump and Musk and the oligarchs. They have been drawing crowds of tens of thousands of people at their rallies. 34,000 in Denver alone is the number. More than 80,000 total in five rallies in the Southwest last week. They are our role models, not afraid of Trump, not afraid to fight. That from Carl. And then we go to Corinne, who says, it's a mistake to keep referring to those who are part of the current regime as stupid or childish. This mistake is part of the reason we are where we are. Democrats and those on the left have underestimated them. They've got folks toiling behind the scenes, finding ways to grab and retain power with a long view. And we're stuck in the schoolyard hurling insults, responding to only the horrors in front of us.
I think both things can be true.
Yeah. Yep. Corinne, thank you very much for the note. We go to Bruce. Until voters on both sides of the aisle are called out for their hypocrisy, we are destined for ineffective and divisive governance. When mistakes are made by either party, demand that they acknowledge the mistake and work to do even better. A mistake is not bad only when the other party commits it. Voters need to hold representatives of their own party accountable just as they demand better from the other party. Similar to voters, pundits, and yes, at times even panels like yours, similarly need to hold both parties accountable. Excusing errors of one party while screaming about mistakes from the other gets us nowhere. That from Bruce.
I mean, I agree that on this panel and in general, we should be holding representatives from both sides of the aisle accountable. And that is, I think, not much of that has happened for a very long time. And, you know, the rate of incumbency return in the House of Representatives is so high. And, you know, most campaigns are not carried out on any sort of details about policy issues. And it really just is, you know, media and personality and things like that. So, you know, you get the government that you deserve if that is the case. But I agree with the letter writer. Accountability needs to be held across the board and across the aisle.
All right. So while we're discussing this, let's talk about another aspect of the interview that Trump did with Kristen Welker in saying that he couldn't care less about the rising automobile prices. He suggested that methods exist for a bid for an unconstitutional third term. Now, a lot of scholars out there that don't understand these methods and how they exist. However, it did not keep the president from saying that he declined to rule out seeking a third presidential term. An unconstitutional act explicitly barred under the 22nd Amendment, saying that, quote, there are methods which you could do it. In an interview with Kristen Welker, Trump suggested that multiple plans had begun to circulate for him to run for a third term. He pointed to unspecified polling as an indicator of his popularity and claimed he had the highest poll numbers of any Republican for the last 100 years. A lot of people want me to do it, Trump said, but we have, my thinking is, we have a long way to go. I'm focused on the current. Asked whether any third-term plans have been presented to him, Trump said, there are methods which you could do it, as you know. Welker then mentioned a hypothetical plan where Vice President J.D. Vance would run in 2028 and pass the baton. Well, that's one, but there are others, Trump responded. I'm not joking, Trump said, but I'm not. It's not far. It's far too early to think about it. Pressed again by Welker on the toll of the presidency and if he would want to serve a third term, Trump said he would be 82 years old in 2028, said, well, I like working.
He's never worked a day in his life. I'm sorry. Like, if your father gave you a loan of $1 million, you've never worked a day in your life. And it's so disingenuous to act as if it's anything different. I had to get that out. Elon, too.
Right. And this might be another, oh, look at that shiny object over there.
Yeah.
Right? While I'm wrecking havoc over here.
Yeah.
Yes, it could be a Vance Trump ticket. I think Vance's ego is too big to say, oh, sure, I'll do that for you, right? Because he's being treated.
That's still
pretty
unconstitutional.
Right. Right. It is still unconstitutional.
He's taking a page out of Putin's book.
Right. Yeah. And this is true. And, you know, to do a constitutional amendment would be a Herculean effort. And I don't think that would happen either. So I think, you know, I think he thinks he's a dictator, and that's why he can do this. But,
you know how you have those little angels on your shoulder?
The
good one and the bad one, the devil and the angel.
Right.
Okay. So I was thinking about this last night, and I remember saying, maybe on this show, but certainly thinking to myself, that there were books after book after book after book after book. We'd had a lot of them on the show in 2020 about how Trump would not leave, that Trump would not leave if he lost the election in 2020, that he would not leave and he would try to overthrow the government.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we came pretty damn close, you know, we came pretty damn close. And I was one like you, Libby, of saying, well, that, you know, that can't happen. We're beyond that. That's not going to happen. And yet, then these things seem to happen. And I don't know how, but
I know
it is certainly something that has been talked about and obviously on his side, but something that is in the works. And I just don't know, even if to Jim's point that it is unconstitutional. Yeah. But if you don't go anywhere, what happens?
Yeah. And I'll, you know, this is not the first time he's brought this up.
No.
So it's making news now, but he's brought it up before and made a bit of news mm-hmm. before. If in the past anybody else who was either the president or was running for the presidency had said such a thing,
right.
It would be utterly disqualifying to basically say, I'm thinking about maybe, perhaps, finding a way to violate the Constitution of the country. And And the fact that there, again, seems to be no real consequences. It makes a little bit of news. We talk about it on the panel. There'll be another, you know, ridiculous statement coming up that will overtake this one. But at the same time, behind the scenes, real plans are probably being made.
And don't forget, the Supreme Court gave him immunity. Right?
Yeah. I mean, he can just kind of do whatever he wants, right, you know, and he knows
it,
too.
Right. Right. And he's never been held accountable for anything. No. He's never taken responsibility for anything. And he was given $1 million by his dad. So really, you know.
The $1 million by his dad. But also, I think an important element, too, is that he learned very well from Roy Cohn.
Yes, he did. Mm-hmm.
And
absolutely.
This is right out of
this
the Roy
Cohn. This is the Roy Cohn playbook.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And as our founder, Dr. Alan Chartek, used to say.
Lying lion.
Well, no. Yes, you're right. He said that. Now I don't remember where I was going.
No,
with
I'm
this.
Sorry.
I apologize. I've lost my moment there. I'll think of it.
Okay. Sorry.
No, that's okay. But that certainly is one thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I mean, that's what he would call him all the time.
Yes. But it is a case where you look at that this could very well happen, and that, I remember now. God has term limits.
This is true.
That was what he said.
That's very true.
God has term limits.
Yep.
All right. Let's see. Let's go to a couple more letters, and then Libby has to go early because she's working really hard because they have to go pass a budget down in Albany there, and
no, actually,
she's going to help.
Well, that too, but they're not here today. But it has more to do with filing petitions.
Well, that's good, we'll get you out of here so you can do the
Thank
work
you.
of the people
of the democracy that we live in.
That's right. Here's how Trump could become a third term president: Vance runs with whomever as a running mate, then win. And the House of Representatives stays Republican, elects Trump as Speaker, then Vance, and his VP resigns, and Trump ascends to the presidency. That's a house of cards.
That seems
to be...
Yeah, that's a bit far-fetched.
Yes,
but
it's a but lot of...
you never know.
A method.
Right, you never know.
But I think that we're much more likely to face a major constitutional crisis way before the end of this term, probably before the end of this year. And that crisis will be triggered by the administration just saying flat out that they're not going to abide by a judicial ruling. And they've already been playing
around that.
And said, well, we didn't get it in time, and when, you know, they've deported people, et cetera. But they may just flat out refuse it. And so all the rest of this becomes just moot, because if they decide they're not going to pay attention to judicial rulings, you know, the Constitution is just out the window.
The junta begins.
We're going to take a break, and we'll let Libby go. Libby, thank you very much, as always.
Welcome.
It's always wonderful to have you here. We'll see you next Monday, as always. We look forward to it. Good luck in your work. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll have 15 minutes or so with both Jim and Emily, and we'll return right after this.
Look the devil right in his eye. Sometimes I hear his footsteps as he follows me from town to town. And I catch the...
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us, and we so appreciate you being here. We want to go to a couple of other topics in the 10 minutes or so that we have left. So, remember that spending bill? It seems so long ago. And it really wasn't. But remember that? Like a week and a half ago?
Yeah.
It's just, okay.
Old news.
So, that stopgap measure to avert a government shutdown amid billions of dollars in member-requested projects another way in which Congress has ceded power on federal spending. So from airports to mentorship programs, local funding disappears as a result of that budget fight. So you look at a museum in Connecticut that was planning to build out its planetarium in Observatory. You look at a boys and girls club in Tennessee and one in Texas where they set to expand their mentorship programs. Or a college in Georgia that wanted to turn part of its library into a business incubator. And at least 24 airports across the United States were on track to renovate their terminals and runways. Those projects and scores of others that had been in line to receive federal funding this year saw that money evaporate when Republicans rallied around a stopgap government funding extension to avert a shutdown. The measure, as it moves forward, and I don't want to rehash the whole Chuck-ism of it, but there is that. It doesn't include earmarks requested by members of Congress for individual projects in their districts and states. Taken together, the projects totaled about $13 billion, according to congressional aides. A drop in the bucket when it comes to federal spending, but their omission is yet another way in which Congress has given up its power of the purse, in this case, its members' ability to direct federal money to projects that help their constituents, and that as a way of starting President Trump's second term. You live this every day. Emily Honan, tell us your thoughts.
Yeah, I think that this earmark program is one of the ways in which government, I wouldn't say one of the last ways, but the most direct way that the government can actually help people. And it's, I think it's a very good program. For those of you who don't know, earmarks are sort of fast track grants. They take a bunch of grant programs and you're allowed to submit very simplified applications for certain projects. I work mainly with municipalities, but one of the projects that I worked on was for a volunteer fire department this year. And, you know, it was for, you know, new fire trucks, which are extremely expensive. I'm talking like $3 million, maybe $2 million. But, you know, and infrastructure projects are big, water and wastewater, you know, road projects, all of those, you know, not very fun, but very necessary projects. And they're just not happening. We had all these, you know, these projects ranging from like $500,000 to $2 million that were accepted. We applied, they're allowed to put forward, I can't remember if it's 15 or 25, but they were accepted. They went through, we're waiting and waiting for them to go through the Senate so they could get officially confirmed. And that's not going to happen now. And we haven't received, oddly enough, I have to give it to Stefanik. She's really determined to hold on to that seat because she's the only one who has so far who has said that I'm just going to submit all of those projects again for you. None of the other members have done that so far. And we're just sort of we don't know what to do. We've already started on the next year's earmarks that we were planning to ask for. And we're just not getting any responses. Meanwhile, the representatives are, you know, really, you know, we saved a government shutdown. You know, we did this for you. We put forward those projects. We told you we're going to get that money and now you're not getting it. But we prevented a government shutdown. And we're great for that.
You know, let's use the fire equipment as an example, or a fire engine, fire truck.
Yeah.
There are, and this is absolutely true, there are rural fire stations in this state with huge fire districts, huge, huge fire districts, where their trucks are older than the oldest one in the New York State Museum.
Oh yeah.
That are operating.
Yeah.
These are not flush organizations that have $1 million trucks. They're trying to get one and sort of patchwork it with other municipalities, yeah, so they can cover an area and offer fire protection and services. So putting holes into that really is dangerous when it comes to the overall apparatus of going to help people.
Yeah.
As one example.
So many, many years ago, I worked in the state legislature. In the state, at the state level, the legislature...
See, you survived.
I survived. I actually enjoyed it very much. I worked for a great senator. And on the state level, back in those days, they had something called member items. Now, they have gone through lots of different iterations and legal scrutiny. And the thing about earmarks on the federal level and member items and back in the old days on the state level is that there were times where they were used in ways that really got the attention of the media. They didn't seem like a process that was transparent, where things were properly vetted, and there were some pretty egregious examples. But overall, in my experience, this is a way where individual members in their districts can respond to specific needs in those districts. And when done right, and when done in a way that really just passes the smell test, it's exactly what you're saying, Emily, that you know, you're dealing with localities that have needs that are immediate, and the member can be involved in addressing those needs. And it can be, you know, really kind of micro local stuff, but these are organizations that need it. And so I think it in terms of the relationship between Congress and the president, this is a bad move. This further moves the power needle toward the president. But it also really affects districts. And I'm curious to see how this is going to play out politically over the next couple of years as organizations, if it's not fixed somehow and this becomes the norm. There's going to be a lot of organizations that say, hey, wait a second, you know, what is going on here? And they're going to be upset. And what will the political ramifications of that be? I'm not sure.
When we go through the fund drive, and we often will work with the, say, food pantries of the Capital District as one example, and Natasha Pernicka, who's the executive director there, says all the time, this isn't the system. This is supposed to fill in the blanks and help those who are falling through the cracks. But we shouldn't be the system. And it's really the same way when we're talking about this municipal funding. It's sort of this or nothing, right? I mean, there's no other way to get it other than, well... Other grants, or if you have the money, or figuring out where it goes from, but almost all of them tie back to the federal government in some way, shape, or form, which make it that much more difficult.
Yeah, and I mean, there is a process. It's not as exhaustive as some of the other grants for earmarks, but there definitely is a process. You have to really argue, why is this in the interest of the taxpayer? And I'm saying, like, look, this is a small town. They're never going to be able to afford this. They're going to bond for half of it. You know, it's never, you know, they never fund the full project. There's usually a 20% match. And, you know, they're going to bond. They're going to do what they can. They cannot raise water rates on their residents to this extent. That's just not fair or feasible. This is exactly what a taxpayer-funded project is supposed to be. They pay taxes to the government, and the government comes back and helps them in their time of need. And it's just very shameful. I think that the representatives should be embarrassed. I think that they should be, I think they should be apologetic, and they're not. They're acting like they did this amazing thing instead of really betraying their constituents, the people who voted for them, the people who trusted them. It's just very sad to see. And it's embarrassing.
So we end with, have you no shame? That's how we end on this Monday morning, the 31st of March. My thanks, of course, to Libby Post, who left us early. Jim Ketterer, Senior Fellow at the Bard Center for Civic Engagement. Always great to have you
great
here.
Great to be here.
And Emily Honan, Grants Analyst based in Albany. And just always wonderful to have you. We love having you here. Thank you very much. We'll be back right after this.